communities. Some people haven't talked to each other, their own parents or a brother or sister, for years. It's silent treatment. You know, you disclosed that you were part of lateral violence. I was too. Saddens me. So we need to replace that violence with kindness and love, like you're saying. You know, because if you want to be the same, and the way you prove it is by hitting someone, you know, like my late uncle would say, you know, nephew, you fly with the crows, you're going to get shot. You know, and when they're in the corn patch, right? Doesn't matter if you're not stealing corn, just because you're with them, you know, you're going to get hit. You know, and so this work that you're doing around promoting, like looking for what works, is the way I see it. You know, we all know what happened. But you're doing the right approach by having them talk about what it is in a storytelling fashion. See, because I know, one thing I know for sure is PowerPoints don't work for our people. You know, go out there and got 5 stacks of PowerPoints or something, or a deck, they call it. You know, it's about storytelling. We come from a storytelling culture. You know, we never wrote anything down. Like, I could tell a story, it might not be exactly the same, but the sentiment is the same. I might embellish it in a different way, but the meaning of the story still is there, it still exists. What do they call that? The moral of this story is, you know, so that whole, even sitting in a circle, is being indigenous. I've gone to communities where people don't want to sit in a circle because it's foreign to them, because they simply never been there before. I remember I went to one community and there was lateral violence. There was actually this young woman got killed. So sad. But I got there and I remember they wanted to be with her friends and her relatives, young relatives. I went in, some of the guys had hoodies on with dark glasses, you know, and they're telling them you got to sit in a circle. So they'd sit, but they would be, in a sense, they're not really there. You know, so I'd done some exercises, you know, and get them to share a little bit about, you know, something safe for them. You know, what makes you feel good, for instance. You know, and then I had them play a game where there was actually physical contact. It's called Amoeba. You know, and they have a team and they'd all hook together, you know, and then the other team's supposed to separate them and see how fast they can do it. You have to be really specific with the instructions about not hurting each other. And as they were doing it, I said, oh no, I shouldn't have done this game. Because there's guys hanging on to gals and stuff, you know, and they're just holding on really tight. And of course, I think about sexual abuse in the community and stuff like that. But to my great surprise, they were laughing, you know, and they were engaged. And then when they come back to the circle, the hoodies were off and the dark glasses were off because they had a chance to laugh at themselves and each other. Then we can start talking about what happened and how they felt about it and what can they do, more importantly. You know, so I followed your same framework about storytelling, and then I added some physical movement in there, you know, like you're saying, dance, for instance. So for these youngsters, it was more learning how to hang on to each other, not let people separate them. And I thought about it and I said, gee, Jerry, that's a perfect game. You know, there I was, but I was doubtful at the beginning of it. So what would you think is the first thing to teach someone to prevent lateral violence, to get this lateral love and stuff happening?
I think the first step is trying to understand what lateral violence is, you know, understanding why it is, what it is, you know, like one time I'll share, a young woman was in our workshop, and we went through what is lateral violence, what does it look like, what are the, you know, how does it manifest itself, and why, you know, why do people do it? And she, you know, at the end of all that, she just said, oh my God, I didn't know this was a thing. I just thought it was the way life was. I just thought that this is just how it is, you know. And so our first step is explaining it and teaching about what it is and why it's there. And I think that right there is 80% of the, you know, the antidote. Because when we understand things and we understand why, it's easier to, I think, be able to figure out where do we go from here? You know, how do we get out of this? Because most of the time it's just happening, and it's happening constantly and all the time. And people, you know, people just maybe go to that place of, this is just, you know, I heard a lot of people say, this is just res life. You know, there were some participants when we were in Alberta, and they kept saying, this is just res life. This is just how it is. And my answer, or my, you know, the way that I address that is I say, no, it's not. It's not res life. This is not who we are. You know, so I think the biggest first step is just understanding what it is and really understanding it fully, you know, coming from a place where we're not being judgmental, and we just say, yeah, we have this. We have this issue, you know, now let's try to understand it. Really coming from a place of curiosity and love rather than a place of, see, look, I told you you were bad, you know, and blaming and shaming and all of that. It's like, we all do it. We all participate in it. So let's figure it out.
Because if we make it a moral issue, like a sin or something, then people get guilted out and shamed, and nobody wants to go there. But I was listening to you, and I was thinking about how this has become normalized, like violence has become normalized, you know, like making sure that they know there's a reason for this, but it's not an excuse for violence, you know, to understand. Because once we understand, we can take action. So cool the way you say it, you know, like to tell them in a way where they're going to listen. I call it relaxed concentration. If a facilitator or a presenter gets people into relaxed concentration, they absorb the teachings. They take it in. You know, so you got a good system there, you know, a good style. You know, and that's the way I work, and I've been working now for a while.
Thank you, Ganshish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's step number one. What's step number two?
Well, step number two is basically, I think, making a commitment. Right. And the commitment is, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people come to a place of, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. It makes absolutely no sense. Once I understand and I understand what it is, and I can see more clearly, I can stand back and look, you know, inward and ask myself, why the heck are we doing this? You know, it's literally stopping us from doing all of the things we want to do. Our communities, you know, has lofty, lofty vision and dreams, you know, and it's all revolves around the wellness of our people, you know, the happiness of our people. That's basically, I think, at the essence of self-determination, you know. And so here we are with all these great, you know, visions and things that we're doing, and we're just getting stopped in our tracks because lateral violence is extremely impactful. Mm-hmm. And people leave jobs, people leave communities, people never talk to each other again, people are unhappy. You know, it just creates so much turmoil. So the next big step is to say to yourself and to say as a community, like this First Nation that, you know, kind of instigated everything, said, we have this problem and we don't want to do it anymore. And they specifically said, and it always happens when we're going to have an election worse, you know. Mm-hmm. So they made a commitment, and, you know, they their intent was very, very articulated. And it began with, we have a problem and we want to fix it, and we're committed to fixing it. So they, all their leadership, including the chief and all the councils and all the staff and every single person in the community, took the workshop. And it didn't, you know, completely eradicate lateral violence, but it at least people were on the same page, you know, and people were committed and to wanting to change it, understanding what it was. And then we developed a few tools in the workshop that will help somebody when they're in the moment, because we recognize when people are in the moment and lateral violence is happening that your stress and anxiety is so heightened that most of the time people just shut down. Mm-hmm. They just shut down, and then they're laying there at 3 a.m. that night thinking of all the great things they could have said, or, you know, but it's too late now. The moment is gone. So we developed, you know, our tools of, approaching it in a loving and kind way, but in a strong way.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically is, it goes back to the boundary, you know, the boundary of, I love you, you're my cousin or you're my colleague or whatever it is, but you cannot treat me like this. Please stop.
You know, I was at a workshop, and this facilitator said to us, I have something to tell you, she says. Love is not a feeling. It's a commitment. Mm-hmm. She says, the example is when a mother receives a baby for the first time, she makes a commitment. I'm going to feed you. I'm going to clean you. I'm going to care for you. That's a commitment. Then, depending, as the years go along, how that commitment is carried out, then the warm feelings start to flow between each other. Mm-hmm. As it's respectful, with boundaries and understanding.
Right.
So to make that commitment is actually saying, it's because I love you.
Yeah.
What you stand for, you're one of us. Your great-grandfather was my relative, you know, so we're going to be committed.
Right.
And I think that part needs to be explained, too, because the residential school is followed the divide-and-conquer rule that the colonizers use. If you can divide the families, you can control them.
Yeah.
That's what happened. Yeah. The divide-and-conquer worked really well.
Right. And my my wonderful colleague, Thomas, he always says that, you know, human beings thrive when they have boundaries and they have guidelines. We don't, you know, like, there's so much state of chaos within our communities, our own Indigenous communities, where there's no boundaries and it's just like everything goes. And as you mentioned, violence has become normalized, violence in all different ways, you know. And so it's true. We really are yearning, you know, for structure. Mm-hmm. And that structure needs to be within our own Indigenous constructs or our own Indigenous, you know, ways of being. In my language, we call it hakusti'i, which means like our own way, basically, our way of life, you know. So we're really I think crying out for that. And people think, oh yeah, we're free and blah blah blah, but no, we're not. We're not free when we're living in chaos. Yeah. We're free when we understand who we are and we're within, you know, those beautiful guidelines and boundaries of what that means.
Yes, I think part of the next step might be when we sit down together and talk about what's acceptable. Because mm-hmm. that's the opposite of that is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
What's acceptable is I'm going to respect you and your boundary. You know, where there's a boundary here, I'm going to respect that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so if we sit down together and make agreements and commitments like you, that community done, a commitment to what's acceptable here and what's not acceptable, and agree on it as families in the community. You know, like, for instance, let's say somebody said, well, let's not swear at children anymore. That's not acceptable. And everybody agreed on it. Then they could remind each other when it happens. And say, hey, listen, that's not acceptable. I know sharing words like that can make a difference with people. I was at a community and I was talking to these graduates. And I said, I'm so happy because they were graduated from plumbing. They're plumbers now. I said, I'm so happy you have a gift to use to help the people. You know, so, and I was talking about being respectful and being careful and sincere with your words, you know, when you're working and you can start your own business. So I was really being motivational because that's what they wanted, right? And I said, you know, have to be careful how you talk to people. As elders say, what goes around comes around. So if you swear at somebody or you swear at your tools or something, you know, it's going to come back and it's going to hurt you. Your tool will break or somebody will lose your job or something. And the MC of that graduation got up and spoke at the end. And he says, I'm gonna copy that elder. He says, I have to be careful because I was watching the hockey game last night. This is a couple of years ago. There's no COVID. And he says, I was swearing at the hockey players and the TV and my little son sitting beside me watching. He said, I don't want him to be like that. See, so that awareness that there's other people in our life and they're watching. What do we want for them? I think that's part of the step too, of our healing.
Yeah, is definitely being examples, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when I think of that first community, it was so powerful that their leadership stepped forward first. You know, because a part of leading is being an example. You know, if I want people to do something, then I need to do it as well. You know, if I want to wear a face, if I want people to wear a face mask, then I need to wear one too, you know? And yep. So their leadership, I think really exemplified, first of all, leadership in itself by saying, I do this, I'm a part of this, and I want to change myself. And so I'm going to step forward and, you know, go through this process. Very, very powerful, you know, really.
It is because I primarily work with adults. Mm-hmm. One of the ways I talk about being indigenous is being a noisy listener. Mm-hmm. For instance, the Crees, when I was talking to Crees, they go, uh-huh. Uh-huh. It means they're listening.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where I'm from, they go, oh. When you're talking, or something, they say, hey, young fella, that's good. So they're letting me know they're still there. So we're noisy listeners, because when you listen, you're showing high respect to the speaker. It's usually because then we know the speaker respects them too. So they noisy listen. Oh, or, you know, I can remember the elders when I first started speaking. And I'd hear them, it was tickling them or is making them feel good. So they're noisy listening. They're quiet, and I knew I said enough or too much. So we learn. So, you know, all of these are learned skills. That's why we can change this. It's man-made problems. We must remember the colonizers were all men. That's why I say majority of our problems are man-made. Our identity is Indians, because they created an identity for us, being drunk, being lazy, being stupid, all of those things, that was created. You tell it to children, they absorb it. There's a good chance it'll become that, because I know I'm the example of that. I was told at residential school that I'd probably be a drunk. And I absorbed that, and I proved it to them, to my loss. You know, so one of the things that I was, I've been wanting to talk to you now for a while, share with you, was about the final stage, is family reconciliation. When we actually do restitution with one another, in ways that are acceptable for the harms done. After we've all admitted, yes, we're all part of this. And then one by one, you start to say, Auntie, you know, that time, I want to give you something. Mom, you know, that time, I want to give you something. to start to do that, because reconciliation means repairing the relationship, doing something tangible, something measurable. You start repairing those relationships. Some of them are pretty severe. Like, I'm working with a young man now. He was drunk driving and he killed 3 people. You know, so I told him, you know, you can do reconciliation, but you must remember most of it's on their time, not your time, because they might not be ready because they lost loved ones. And they're going to blame you and stuff like that. But I said, don't give up on that. And I said, you know what? The person you can change is yourself. You can't change those ones. They're going to do it on their own if they do it. And our prayers are that they will forgive you, you know, and see that you've changed and you're sincere. So I see that as a kind of the final step, is reconciliation, you know, in the community. Because we got the Hatfield McCoys happening too, family against family, you know, clan against clan. So before we used to have the shame feast, one of our clan members hurt your clan, oh, we'd shower you with gifts. Just keep giving you gifts till you say that's enough. Then it's never to be spoken of again. I say that's such a beautiful way. You know, that's indigenous. Remember, this series is called Indigenous Is. And I'm so glad to share with you, because you're showing Indigenous Is. What is indigenous? It's being respectful. You know, it's storytelling. I believe storytelling is a big part. Because when someone starts telling their story, they're freeing themselves. But it needs to be in that safe setting, or we aren't reaffirming anger, fear, or depression. But letting them know this is a once and for all chance where you can get rid of it forever. Put it where it's not going to hurt anybody anymore. Let's deal with this. Yeah. So this is a time when I ask you for a message to give to the people. Let's pretend we're talking to all the Indigenous communities in Canada. So you have a choice to talk to the grannies or the grandpas or the mums or the dads or the children or grandchildren. Or if you want to talk, give a message to all of them, say to you all or whatever, what would you say to them about radical kindness and love?
I would say, you know, to the entire community of Indigenous people across Turtle Island, because we're all impacted by this, you know, and we've all been hurt, and we've all, you know, I've seen so many stories of people who have, you know, just risen with strength, determination, and resilience and move forward. But I always heard my mom say, our people are beautiful, our people are respectful, and our people are noble. And we just must remember that. We have to remember who we really are, who we really are, and walk forward with that.
That's a wonderful message. Indigenous Is. We're noble, we're beautiful, we're kind, we're respectful, we're generous. Oh, that's where we come from.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful way of life. I really enjoyed speaking to you. Do you have any questions or final thoughts you'd like to say?
I just want to say thank you so much, Gunashish Masicho Sonithan, for inviting me to hang out with you today and to talk and to have such a great discussion. It really was, uplifting for me. And I really thank you for the work that you do and for your commitment as an elder and a knowledge keeper and somebody promoting unity and wellness in our community. So thank you so much for that.
BirdNote. Collecting data on wild birds is crucial for their conservation, but it requires huge amounts of effort. Researchers may spend many hours in the field recording all the birds they see and hear, or following the lives of specific individuals. This takes a lot of training, time, and money. One way to help streamline this process is with gizmos called Autonomous Recording Units, or ARUs. For days or months, these recording devices eavesdrop on the environment around them, including the songs and calls of the local birds.
HMS Site 103, start time now.
Recently, researchers tracked the lifespans of male savanna sparrows over 6 years using only recordings that captured individuals' uniquely identifiable songs. Identifying the songs picked up on recordings can be almost as time-consuming as in-person fieldwork. But new AI tools are quickly making it easier to analyze the audio. This could open up new possibilities for expanding or replacing in-person bird surveys and monitoring secretive species. You can even try a version of this at home with smartphone apps and specially made devices that record songs from your neighborhood. Who knows? Maybe you'll capture the call of a bird you've never observed in your area before. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Remmel.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
I was born in a body with more than one soul. Two spirit together. Je transcends, je dérange, je transcends, je dérange, je transcends.